I wonder if I, because it's 90 degrees out here and I really can't turn the air conditioning off.
Yeah. Are you sure you have time?
Yeah, then let's do it.
I promise it'll be better.
Are we going to tell people we're doing a round two?
I think we should.
Okay.
Why not?
Round two, take two.
Full disclosure. Tell me when you're ready.
I am rolling and I'm opening my Little Debbie Nutty Bars. All right, what are we talking about?
Hey, it's Tuesday, and we've already actually done this once, so it is still on Taking Pictures. I'm still Jeffrey Sidoris from Faded and Blurred, and with me is still the soon to be food coma dessert happy Bill Wadman.
Yum yum yum.
Can I just say, God damn, that Chipotle sandwich looked good.
Didn't it look good?
Oh, Jesus.
It's so good. It's got black beans on it, and then fried chicken things, lettuce, tomato, and chipotle mayo.
Oh, Bill sent me a photo from his diner there. Is it in the building? It's the one down the building, right?
It's a block away.
Okay. Amazing looking chipotle chicken sandwich.
It's good stuff.
Damn, that looked good.
All right. What are we doing? We did the show. We're redoing the show. Why are we redoing the show?
We're redoing the show because I've been struggling lately.
Okay.
And there's no other way to put it. I have been struggling with who I am and what I am.
Stuck or swinging? Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm not sure. You said something when we were talking before about, you know, I've sounded like I've had a chip on my shoulder for a little while.
A little bit, yeah.
About something. And I don't know what that is. And we don't really know what that is.
Well, that's what we're here to talk about.
But, you know, I think it'll get into where we want to go with the Dylan and Zappa things. I just don't feel like I have much direction at the moment. There are little glimpses of it here and there, but, and I'm not saying this for, so please don't feel like you have to respond or, you know, send any, I just don't feel like I'm good at anything anymore.
Yeah. Have you ever felt like this before?
Sometimes, not often.
And has it gone away?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's, I feel like I was good at something. Maybe I was good at a lot of things. Maybe I was only good at a couple things. I don't really know. I've kind of lost objectivity. And, you know, I was on one sort of path and got a little taste of what it was like to succeed somewhat, whatever that means. And maybe it was just a money thing. Maybe it was just, you know, going to a big building in a big office and
getting stuff to direct deposited every other Friday.
Right. And that changed. The market changed. The bottom fell out. I mean, you were part of that.
Yep.
And we've joked about it several times. You know, those days are gone and will never come back. And you kind of stay on sort of a tangential kind of trajectory to that for a little while. And then you try something new and that may work or may not work. But I've just
did you feel like you were, just to back up a half a second.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you were forced out of what you used to do? Like you couldn't do it anymore? Did you choose not to do it anymore? Does that make sense?
Well, I mean, the dot-com bubble burst.
Sure, yeah.
You know, and people went, wait, how much were we paying for these things?
Yeah.
You know, wait, what?
Yeah.
So I think there was you know, different way of looking at it. There were probably both sides of it.
Yeah.
You know, I walked away after trying to stay in it for a while after the bubble burst and tried to figure out something to do because it kind of felt like, you know, you were banging your head up against a wall.
Yeah.
You know, and I, you know, we've talked about this several times. I've always been in this sort of illustrate-y, painterly, design-y kind of thing, but nowhere near you know, like your friend Craig, who is a fantastic designer and is as being embraced by the industry as a fantastic designer and sort of leading the charge of what graphic design means in the next phase of graphic design's history.
And you feel like you should be there or
no,
that-
No.
Or do, is it that, I guess my question is, did you not think you were good at that stuff, or did you not think that you were good enough of that at that stuff, or did you not enjoy doing it?
I used to think. I mean, I used to think I was really good at stuff. Yeah. I used to think I was a really good designer, whether that was web or graphic, not in the same way that your friend Craig works, but in my sphere.
Right.
I thought I was really good. I thought I was really good in college. I thought I was really good. And I don't know if my interests change. I don't know if inspiration on that path stopped for whatever reason.
But you fear that it was hubris.
Maybe.
Yeah.
All I know is that I'm mid 40s. I've got my birthday coming up in a couple weeks, and I just don't know what I'm good at anymore. If anything.
Yeah.
You know, I think I'm an okay writer. I think I'm, you know,
I think I'm more than an okay writer, but go ahead.
No, thank you. I think I'm okay in Photoshop. I think I'm okay in photography. There's just nowhere where I feel like
you stand out.
I stand out. Yeah. I mean, I think
but that, but that's in comparison to whom?
I don't know. That's the thing is what,
if you're comparing yourself to Pressfield and Stephen King and, you know,
but even, you know, Pressfield wasn't always Stephen Pressfield as he is now.
Right.
Or, you know, Stephen King wasn't always Stephen King. You know, you have to, I get that. I get the intellectualizing of, you have to start somewhere, but I feel like I started a long time ago and I'm still, I don't know, not very far.
I know what you mean. It's funny. It's like when you're busy. I go ups and downs. Right? There'll be months where I've got a half a dozen. I'm shooting every few days. You know, and then there'll be months where I have two shoots, whatever it is. And I'll think to myself, when things are rolling, I'll be like, oh, see, this is how it should be. This is what I've worked towards, and people are finally noticing, and things are finally taking off.
Right.
And, you know, that whole sort of, I'm on a roll, get out of my way.
Right. Right.
But then invariably, like, the pendulum swings the other way, and I'm just like, wow, how am I going to pay rent 2 months from now?
You know? Right.
And those things, I mean, that's, you know, some people, my therapist included, would say, well, you know what? That's the life of an artist. You chose. If you wanted stability, this was not the way to go.
Right.
Now, I don't. Sometimes I feel like, well, that's not always the case, because we both know plenty of artists who have stable lives.
Yeah.
Stable livings.
Plenty of artists that are stable livings, stable home lives, stable emotionally.
Sure.
Their art or their craft isn't from a place of struggle. It's simply from a place of joy.
Yeah. But I mean, sometimes it's, you know, other family members helping a little bit more with the living. Maybe it's, you know what I mean? There's all kinds of other things in there. It is interesting always to me, though, to think that all of these people that we choose as photographer of the week, the people we choose as, you know, the people we hold up, and we say, oh, ideally my life would be like this guy or that guy. During their lives, they probably didn't, most of the people didn't look at it as, oh, wow, I'm doing just fine. I'm rocking and rolling. You know,
very few.
Right. It was a week to week struggle, just like it is with us. Right. You know what I mean? I remember hearing a story that I won't repeat any names, just keep it out of the thing, but a photographer friend of mine who knows a lot of big photographers of the day was working on some sort of gig and got the call for this magazine thing, and it was not a huge thing. It was like a $2,000 job like 20 years ago or 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets a call like a week before, and they said, hey, you know, I've got to take this away from you and give it to so-and-so, this really well-known photographer. And he's just like, what are you talking about? Like, you know, first of all, you gave it to me. Second of all, he's this really well-known photographer. Like, he doesn't, you know, need this stupid $2,000 job.
Right, right.
And the guy was like, actually, he's in a bad way, and he really needs work right now. You know what I mean? Or whatever
wow.
it is.
Yeah.
Right. And I heard this story, and I was like, wow, that's crazy. You know? Because I know the people that he was talking about, and I was like, see, you would never think that he would have ever been in a position like that.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people are, you know, and there are the elites of the industry that are rocking and rolling all the time. And of course it's a bell curve, right? There are those people who out there who are just rocking it.
Right.
But, you know, as we've talked about, a lot of that has a lot more to do. I mean, yeah, they work hard. Yeah, they do this, that, and the other thing. But there's a lot of other variables in there. There's a luck variable. You know, there's a who you meet while you happen to be walking down the street and you bump into some friend of yours who's walking with some other person who is your, you know, the client that gives you a $50,000 job the next month, you know.
Right.
Those things are just that you can't account for them, you know. But I guess all of this is to say, I wonder how much I only find that I think the way that you're thinking, and I do a lot when I'm not busy.
And maybe that's part of it. You know, maybe yeah. that's part. I don't
because
know.
Because I don't feel useful at the moment.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I have all these skills and everything. Just sitting here. Right. Yeah.
I question it all. I question whether I've simply spent my life buying into some sort of parental cheerleading fantasy. You know,
that you're good enough. You're smart enough.
Exactly.
You could be anything you want to be.
Yes. Well, guess what? You can't. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, that whole thing goes, that cuts a number of different ways.
You know, and I know that it'll pass, or I hope that it will. It has to.
It better.
But it, yeah. But at the moment, I go through periods of feeling absolutely lost.
Yeah.
And feeling like I couldn't string a sentence together if my life depended on it.
Feeling like if you tried, it would be terrible, or it's just not worth trying because it's not going to do any good anyway.
Both.
Yeah.
Depending on the day.
Yeah. Those are two very different feelings.
Yeah. And you know. and they are doing battle with one another.
Yeah.
You know, and then there are sometimes where I'll something will click and I'll sit down and something will come out start to finish and I won't change a word. But that sort of defeatist in me looks at it and goes, well, yeah, okay. For the, you know, for what it is, it's good. There's always that qualification. For what it is, it's good. Yeah, you know, it's good for a web thing, or it's not. It, you know, you're not going to win a Pulitzer with this,
right?
And is that the goal? Is recognition the goal? I don't even know that anymore. You know, I say that I'm doing this for me, but am I?
Sure.
Does that make it easier? Is that the easier pill to swallow when you say that I'm just doing this for me, so I'm the only one that's disappointed by
right.
it?
So if, or the flip side, if no one else gives a crap, I can ignore the fact that no one gave a crap because I can just say that I've done it for me and it doesn't matter what else anybody thinks.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So I don't know.
You make something good, what you think is good, and it doesn't get noticed. See, I don't know which is worse. Doing something you think is good and having it not get noticed, or doing something you think is crap and people loving it.
Right. And that happens too.
Yeah.
where you, it's something, it's an aside.
Yep.
You know, you do something as a whim, mm-hmm. and that's what gets noticed. And you go, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Do you not see?
Yeah.
All of this effort that's been expended here. Do you not see this? This yeah. is the thing that you want to celebrate?
That happens to me all the time.
And how do you deal with it?
Sometimes it makes me wonder why I, you know, why I bother thinking too much in the first place, because apparently when I don't think is when people notice. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yes. You know, what I think are great ideas go largely unnoticed or unrealized. Uh-huh. Or what I have thought in the past, you know.
Unrealized by you or unrealized, unnoticed by the masses?
Maybe both.
Yeah.
You know, there are any number of things that I have in, you know, notebooks all over my room here that...
Cut to Jeffrey's apartment looking like the scene from Seven.
Yeah, exactly. There's like all these composition notebooks everywhere. What I've done will be studied for years. Yeah.
No, but best laid plans, right?
Yeah.
But I guess...
So do you just pay attention to what you feel good doing is the thing?
You know, there was a TED Talk the other day that I saw a link to on Upworthy. Just kidding.
Okay.
I don't think it was on Upworthy. I think it was actually in Huffington Post, but almost as bad.
Yeah.
By Mike Rowe, you know, the Dirty Jobs yeah, guy.
Sure, sure, sure.
And I didn't watch the whole thing, but apparently the gist of it was, you know, doing what makes you happy is a terrible thing because some of the happiest people are the people who do the crappiest jobs. Was apparently what his TED Talk was about.
Huh.
That somehow happiness and fulfillment are two different things.
Okay.
Or something along those lines. But, you know, it kind of gets down to what is the alternative for you? You know, if you don't sit there and take the chance that you're going to work a whole lot and nothing is going to come of it, almost like a creative entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because that's kind of how it feels sometimes. I feel like I'm starting Absolutely. Companies all the time, you know, artist companies, art yeah. companies, and they're not taking off, or it doesn't take off, or it takes off a little bit, but not enough to, you know, pay the rent for, to use the entrepreneurial term, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're kind of like, well, how many times do I have to do this before something catches fire?
Right. Well, and you and I have talked about this. You know, we have X number of followers and right. likes and yeah. click throughs and all
tens
this other
tens of thousands
stuff.
Of people are looking at our stuff, and what does it get us?
What is it really doing?
Right.
And am I in this funk because that's what I'm looking at? Am I guilty of the sort of Seth Godin, you know, spending too much time looking at likes and hit counters?
Yeah. So Seth Godin who's probably looking at the hit counter on his site right now.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, but am I, you know, putting too much stock in all of that? And I just need to keep doing what I do. I don't know.
Well,
because
last week when I was working on this wall thing that I'm building in the corner.
Right.
I was listening to Jim Croce. Did I talk about this last week?
No.
I've been on a Jim Croce kick
like
lately.
Junkyard dog Jim Croce?
Yeah. Yeah.
What is it? Can't pull the mask off.
Old Lone Ranger, and you can't mess around.
Don't mess around with Jim.
Jim. Yeah. But there's a song that in it, well, two things. Number one, I found it very satisfying just sit there listening to Jim Croce and randomly painting on the wall. Like sure. I found that satisfying somehow.
Centering.
Yeah, there's yeah. something about that is just it felt good. You know what
analog,
I mean?
Analog, baby.
It's analog, and the music was on, and I was having like a little bit of a flow moment. And you mm-hmm. know, there were a couple of times like 10 years ago that I wanted to try painting, so I went and bought a bunch of oil stuff and would just blast music and paint terrible, terrible, terrible things.
Right.
But I got such a sense of satisfaction out of the doing.
Mm-hmm.
Which was really, really great, you know. But there's a song, a Jim Croce song called "I've Got a Name." You know that one?
Okay, I don't know this song.
And it's like, I forget the lyrics, like, you know, and I carry it with me like my daddy did and blah, 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 blah.
Oh, yeah, I do know that song.
I carry it with me like my daddy did.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. Okay. I never knew that was the name of the song.
Something like that. Moving me down the highway.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Okay, sure.
And I was listening to that song and I was just like, beyond what I say that I am and the people in my life like Conrad and you and my friends, right? What am I? Who am I?
Who am, yeah. Yeah.
What am I doing? Am I Bill Wadman, the son of Bill Wadman who, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, what does that even mean? You know, I'm thinking this as I'm like spackling the wall.
Right.
But there is a certain sense of all I am are my actions. The only thing I have are my actions.
Am I looking too far beyond the headlights? Am I worrying about what I can't see?
You may be worrying about what you can't control.
Yeah.
Or rather, if you want control, if you want power, if you want certainty, there are ways for you to do that. You know, you could start a website tomorrow that put up the latest gear PR things.
Sure.
And get
more juice.
Get lots of sponsorship from all kinds of strap companies and blah, 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 blah.
Right.
You know that you could do that and it would look better than the other guy, but there's something about it that you don't want to do because you realize that that's not what it's about.
Right. For me.
For you.
Yeah.
So there's a certain amount of, okay, yeah, you can get frustrated with the fact that you don't think you're good at anything, but maybe you are good at a lot of things. You're just not being noticed for what you're good at because the people out there don't appreciate that or don't notice it or haven't noticed it enough.
It feels weird to be in this sort of, you know, existential kind of, I don't know. It's not a breakdown. It's a crisis, maybe.
Well, they do call it a midlife crisis for a reason.
Yeah, yeah. So I should just go buy a Porsche.
Yeah. Well, you know, 30 years ago, you may have. That would have made sense.
I should go buy a walker with flames on it.
But I mean, you are at a point in your life where there are decisions to be made of how you want to live the rest of your life. Yeah. No?
Yeah. I mean, I think, sure.
And is part of the problem, not to get too deep on the show, but is part of the problem that you're having some of those decisions, you know what the decisions are, you're just having a hard time saying so.
Sure.
And I have this lately as well. I'm in a very similar position where I know there are certain steps that I can take, that I should take, that I think that I want to take, but actually taking them, I'm paralyzed.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I know you're on the edge
of that abyss.
Yes, yes. But you also know, you also realize that if you were to say, all right, I've got 13 things on my plate right now, and I know number 1, 5, 7, 9, and 12, I know the answers to, and I'm just procrastinating.
Right.
1, 5, 7, 9, 12. Done. Move it out. Now I've only got 7 things to worry about. But
maybe, sure.
And for you, that could be like thinking about moving somewhere. Could be thinking about starting your new project. Could be thinking about whatever it is. Right.
Whatever those things are. Sure.
Right. And I think sometimes I feel like you have no control of how other people perceive the work that you do.
Right.
I mean, you can try, you can hire PR people and try, but at best you can put a spin on the ball.
Right. Right.
You know, and even then, if my work suddenly got noticed because I hired some fancy PR person who knows the right people to get articles written about me, I would feel pretty crappy about myself if I realized that's actually what happened.
What the tipping point was. Sure.
Right.
I know this will pass, but it just, the last few weeks maybe have just been a lot. There's been a lot of anxiety around what I am or am not doing. you know? And I think it...
Is there something you think you're not doing?
There's probably any number of things that I should be doing or am not doing.
Yeah, but I mean, there's an action. Do you, in your head, do you have a list of like, yeah, I really should be doing that?
There are a few things that I probably could take action on.
Do you feel like you're going to fail if you do, or that is they're the wrong decisions, or is it sort of the devil you know? The situation you're in now is better than the potential downside of some other situation.
That's I think on there's the other probably side. There's probably a little of both of that.
Yeah.
Both of those things. You know, there is this, and again, this is something I talked about with David, was the addiction to certainty, that you want to know how it's going to turn out before you want to know that there's, you know, a big, you know, pool full of Cool Whip when you jump off.
Sure.
And, you know, you don't want it to be rocks and concrete.
And for those handful of people out there for whom everything does seem to turn to gold, they probably think they actually have that.
Right. Or yeah. Do they even worry about it? That's the other thing is like...
Well, they don't have to worry about it because it's never gone wrong before.
Right.
I mean, those people are actually, that's almost even more dangerous position, because then you're in a situation where you don't know how to handle it when things go bad.
I think
you and I know how to handle things when things go bad. Yeah. We don't know how to handle things when things go well.
And maybe there's something in there about what you deserve or what you, you know, I don't know. That gets into a whole other.
No, that's fine. But I mean, you, we've talked about that on the show. You've used those words and bounced them back at me to say, well, there's no such thing as what you deserve.
Right.
You know? And you're right, but there's still this sense that it's like if I go in and haul 12 piles of coal out of the coal mine, I deserve whatever money 12 piles of coal gets me.
Right.
But in our industry, it doesn't work like that. You know, I could haul out the whole damn mine and have nothing to show for it at the end of my life.
Right. Except calluses and black lungs or
whatever. Yeah, right. You know, there is a lot of work in all of this that doesn't guarantee any sort of payback.
Right.
But
I do enjoy it. And that's what I have such a tough time with.
And I think part of the reason why you enjoy it is because you realize that you are doing it for itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're doing it for love, not money, to some extent, you know?
Sure.
If it was guaranteed, if writing every single post guaranteed you $250 in your bank account or whatever, would that be satisfying to you, or would it then feel like a job?
Feels like a job, sure.
Right. So it's this weird thing where you don't want the certainty and yet you crave it.
Yes.
And I think that there's a lot of our listeners. I mean, how many emails do we get of, you know, I have this job because I have a wife and kids and a thing, but I hate it and I want to do this and I don't know how to get started, or I don't know if it's the right thing, or maybe I should just, you know, all of those questions, right?
Yeah.
You know, some people take the leap and they fly, you know, because there was a really good updraft when they jumped.
Right.
You know, some people take the leap and they fall into the water and they realize they're actually a better swimmer than they are a flyer.
I think where I'm at is just, I'm holding on to the buoy. There could be something in any direction, but I'm holding on lighter than I was.
Yeah.
But I'm still holding on to it.
Because you don't know which direction to swim. Or
partially.
Because you don't know what's in that direction that you want to swim?
Partially, I don't know which direction to swim. Partially, you know, you can see a potential. You can see landfall. You just, it's further away than it seems.
Yeah.
And you don't know if you've got the sort of creative stamina to get you there.
Yeah. Well, I think that's one of those situations where it's better to be dumb and not know how much work it's going to take to do it.
Yeah.
You know, I've been working on doing this new series and there's sort of these things that involve a number of people at locations, and I've done one of them and I have three more in the works. And my big problem is just logistics of getting everyone in the same place at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, okay, when can we use the restaurant? Okay, on Tuesdays and Saturdays. All right, well, when do you have to work? And when can you work? And what time can you be? You know what I mean?
Right.
And that's my biggest, like, block right now is this BS logistical crap that just drives me crazy because it's like, this has nothing to do with what I'm trying to do, and yet it's everything to do what I'm trying
right.
to do.
It's the stone in your way.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, until I can get all these people here at the same time, at the same place, I can't do what it is that I care about. And yet at the same time, there's also this feeling like once I do get everyone there, for every person that's there, the stakes are higher for me because I feel like, oh, now the pressure's really on and you have to stop thinking about that other things. Think about the picture you're going to take. No, no, no. Did you notice that her shoes are pink and she has her foot twisted a certain way? Oh, shoot. Right. I got to worry about that guy over there because he's, you know, and then you start second guessing yourself and then you realize that you're not in the moment at all. And now you've just wasted all the time that you took to get all those people there in the first place or whatever, what have you.
Right. Right.
You know, it's scary doing this stuff, right? You should be scared. I think
I'm terrified.
Well, then maybe you're actually doing a better job than you think. Mm-hmm. I think what it is that, I don't know. Look, my two cents.
Yeah.
Whatever it is, you got to make a decision, you know?
Yeah.
Until you make a decision, think about it this way. Until you make the decision, you're not doing anything.
Yeah.
You know? And what is worse?
Yeah. No.
You know? Isn't if you're not going to do anything, well, then you might as well go get a job at Universal doing, you know,
that's right,
movie interstitials.
Right.
You know, I'm sure you could get really great benefits. And, you know, at your age, that's something you should really think about.
That's right.
But I don't know. I don't know what I'm trying to say.
That's right. This pill holder isn't going to fill itself.
That's what I'm saying. Look, you know, wait, can we talk about a little bit about these links?
Yeah, let's lighten it up a little bit. What are you going to tell kids about photography? Let's talk about that.
Oh well, I
that's a cute story.
I went to my nephew Bert's preschool class.
You were show and tell Uncle Bill.
Yeah.
Uncle Billy.
Which by the way, apparently Bert's new thing is to put poop in front of everything.
So is it Uncle Poop Billy or is it Poop Uncle Billy?
I'm Poop Uncle Billy.
Poop Uncle Billy.
And Miss Conrad is Aunt Poop.
Aunt Poop.
For some strange reason.
There you go.
And apparently every book that Conrad read to Bert, because she loves reading to Bertie, had to put poop in the title. So there's one called Secret Pizza Party or something like that. So that became Secret Pizza Poop Party.
Right.
You know, that was hysterical.
Could it be Poop Point Break?
Yeah, Point Poop Break.
Road Poop House?
Yeah, exactly. That would just be Poop House, I think. Anyway, so there I am in Bertie's class, and there are 10 3.5-year-olds turning four. Next week.
They're learning about photography outside. This is not you. You're not just a surprise guest. They're learning about photography, right?
Oh, yeah. Bertie has... They have already studied. God, I wish I had it. Let me look at my email if I have it. They already studied all kinds of like classic stuff about photography. They've learned the difference between digital cameras and film cameras. They've already shot through rolls of disposable film. They have studied how Edward Muybridge was the bridge between still photography and motion pictures, right? Stuff some of our listeners are going to be like, wait, huh? Wait, what was that? I'm going to have to go look that guy up.
Yeah.
Bert knows all about it. You're going to go ask Bert.
And is he excited about it? Is he into it?
I don't know. It's one of those things where I don't know if that's the thing for him or if it's just sort of it's just one of the things they learned about, you know what I mean?
Right.
And they go to like the galleries and they'll look at the stuff. I mean, the kids, you know, he's at the Smithsonian. This is the world that he lives in. His school, right. I mean, his class is actually in the Natural History Museum, you know, it's that kind of thing.
Wow.
So, there I am, and they're like, okay, everyone come sit down because we have a special guest. And I'm like, who's the special guest? I'm like looking behind me, you know, a special guest. Where? It's like Uncle Billy, you know. So Uncle Billy goes and sits down, and I'm talking to these kids, and trying to explain to them something about photography that they haven't already learned, but that is specific to me, you know.
Right.
But
these kids, in a way that they can understand.
Jeffrey, these kids are four. You know what I mean? Like, they don't have the vocabulary emotionally or verbally for me to get into a discussion like we're having here today.
So safe bet that you didn't get into adjustment layers.
Did not get into adjustment layers. That's next week.
So they're still destroying.
They haven't gotten
their
images. There yet. Yeah.
They're still using Command U.
Yeah, they're they haven't even gotten there yet. They're actually using coffee developers to.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. But I talk to them about how I take pictures of people, and I talk to the people, and I, you know, try to take a picture that is representative of the person, so that somebody seeing the picture can get a sense of what that person's really like. And, you know, I talked about how I use a certain kind of camera and why I use that camera and all that kind of stuff. And it was really sweet, because like, some of the kids were like, I already have a camera, and like, my camera's better than yours, you know.
Nice.
My daddy
has flames on it.
Yeah. It was kind of like that. And the mother of one of the kids who was talking like that was there, and she's just like, yeah, he has a Fisher Price, my first camera.
Yeah.
But it
will kick your Mark III to the curb.
Yeah, exactly.
Make no mistake.
Yeah. And, you know, and at the end, I threw them all up against the wall, and, you know, I had them act like dinosaurs, and we took pictures, and, you know, it was cute. But just trying to, what do you say to a kid like that? You know, how do you get them started?
Right.
It's a tough thing, you know? I feel like, is photography one of those things you should try to get a kid into, or wait till the kid is interested in it?
I don't know. Not being a parent, I don't know. I kind of like the idea of letting kids arrive there on their own. But if they're never exposed to it, then how do they arrive there at all?
Right.
You know, I mean, my dad used to let me make pictures with his 35mm camera, and it was no problem. You know, it was just another item. It wasn't precious. It wasn't special, the camera, to him. It was just something to record his surroundings.
Yeah. Where for my father, the camera was the thing I couldn't touch.
Right.
Yeah. I wonder how much that sort of, you know, lack of access made it more interesting. The whole, like, kids aren't interested in drinking if you let them drink at 12, you know.
Right. Yeah, I mean, maybe you had kind of this built-in, I don't know, there was a target on a camera for you from a very young age.
Yeah.
Because it was out of reach, because it was off limits.
I think that might be true.
Are you somehow, is there some sort of connection to your father about using a camera?
Absolutely. Yeah. You mean do when I shoot my camera, when I shoot my camera.
Yeah. When I take it out the holster.
Yeah. When I pull it out, you know, whip it out. Yeah. I definitely think about my father when I take pictures. I definitely think about what my father would think about me being a photographer. Sometimes I wish my father could see how good I've become, you know, because I didn't take pictures before he died, really. There's sort of a, I feel like it's one of those things that actually he could understand. Like, when I was in music, my father had a tin ear. He wasn't really a musician in any way. And so there was this sense that, you know, his music, he didn't understand why I did what I did or how I did what I did.
And photography was somehow different for him? Did he look at the camera as something other?
He used to have a dark room in his bathroom when he was first married and stuff. So I think he would have appreciated it in a way that he wouldn't have.
My father, it was a tool to document
birthdays and weddings and
where you were at any given moment.
Yeah.
It was strictly a documentary tool. That's it.
Should cameras go back to that? That was kind of nice, right? Like, we're going to take a couple pictures here at the Grand Canyon to say that we're at the Grand Canyon. And then, you know, the next picture on the roll will be when we got to Vegas the next day.
And that's exactly what it was. I mean, if you look at rolls of film from my childhood, there are one or two pictures, and maybe weeks had passed between the next picture.
Yeah.
Because you take a couple pictures, yeah, and you put the camera back.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you go take it out, and you take a couple pictures, and you put it back.
There's something nice about that, though, right?
I think so, yes. I mean, you've ribbed me about it. That's the way I treat my camera. You know, I take a couple pictures.
It's true.
I do.
And I sometimes I wish I would be the same way, you know? Like, sometimes on a shoot, like, I was shooting that mother of that Ryan Lewis guy, Ryan Lewis's
right,
mom.
Sure.
And I had a good picture of her with this like yellow background and the way the sun was coming through this sort of scrim that was at this studio. And it was a nice picture and she had a good look on her face and she was leaning there. And I think I probably took 40 pictures that are all very similar because I was trying to get it just right, like waiting for her face to get just right, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think about it and I go, you know what? Back in the day, a photographer wouldn't have taken that picture 40 times. He would have taken maybe 3 or 4.
Right.
You know, and you get what you get. You move on. Yeah. And I find myself getting stuck by the numbers, you know, by the fact that I want to get the perfect version of this picture. Then I want to get the perfect version of this picture. Then I want to get the first perfect version of this picture. All right, now the magazine has 3 great pictures for them to use as opposed to 20 different setups.
I think there's something to be said about that.
Yeah.
You know, I mentioned this before, but there's a great interview with Neil Peart from Rush and Strombo, George Strombolopoulos, going through moving pictures track by track.
Right.
Right. And they were talking about.
You're not going to sing YYZ? I'm sorry. YYZ.
Yeah. And it was fascinating to hear him talk about how they approached this record. They rented this farm in I think it was in Quebec. And, you know, Neil would go and spend the days in the little cottage on the water writing lyrics while Alex and Getty were writing music. And then they would get together at night and play. And this was a time when you played everything in the same room with each other. There weren't, you know, you didn't do your part and then they did their part. All of their songs, even to this day, are designed to be played live. So they played the songs over and over and over and over and over again until they got them right, until everybody played it correctly.
Yeah. Yeah. I always liked that about them.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think that's to a large degree the way you and any number of other people approach photography is you will shoot chimp, shoot chimp, shoot chimp, shoot, shoot, shoot chimp. And until you feel that you've gotten it right, you'll allow yourself that workability.
Yeah. Yeah. But I feel like sometimes that is hamstringing me. You know, that if I had more limitations, that I need to trust myself more, you know,
maybe. Yeah. I mean, look, there's great stuff that comes out of limitation, but your limitation is often time.
Yes, absolutely. Yep, that is generally the one limit, right, that I have. Yeah. Now
you get 5 minutes or you get 10 minutes.
But
at
the same time, by limiting the pictures per setup, I could get more setups. And maybe I will find something that wasn't the first 4 things that I noticed when I walked in the room and have to figure out what I'm going to do.
Right.
You know, it's that 5th thing while they're walking out the door by the coat closet that it ends up being the one. You know?
Yeah. And you go, oh, wait. Can we try one more thing?
Yep. And a lot of times that's the one.
Yeah.
You know, and you can't. And then if you leave a shoot and it doesn't feel right, like you feel like you left something on the table, then you kick yourself for not taking those extra 3 shots.
Right.
You know, so it's like there's a double-edged sword, but I think there's a practice in there that I think needs work for me.
Mm-hmm.
Which is to trust what you're doing, to trust what you've done and to move on.
Right.
And I think that's a lesson that a lot of, you know, younger, less experienced photographers are especially now with digital. I mean, you could just keep shooting. It's like, at a certain point, there's diminishing returns. You know, you got to trust what it is and move on.
That's a lesson that I still struggle with. I need to, you know, do my thing and move on, whether it's writing a piece or having a conversation or making a photograph, whatever it is.
Yeah.
I still struggle with jumping in with both feet.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. We should, I was last week, you know, I figured out what it is, why I got to this Zappa thing and this Dylan thing. I think it was actually because of the Rush documentary you made me watch.
But you loved it, didn't you?
It was really good.
It was good.
I've always liked Geddy Lee. They always seem like nice guys, those guys. It was pretty funny, though. There's one scene where some woman comes up to Geddy to get his autograph, and Alex is sitting right next to him.
Oh, in the restaurant.
Yeah, no one cares, right? Yeah,
just has no clue.
He's like, you do understand that he's sort of the leader of the band right here. And he's like, oh, yeah, that's great.
but you're Geddy Lee.
Yeah. It's funny having a certain look, right? You get noticed.
Sure.
It's really funny.
Alex definitely has more of that sort of everyman, whereas Geddy is very unique.
And he's not singing. And you know what I mean? Like he's right. Like if you were going to list the members of Rush in importance as great as he is, I don't think you'd put Lifeson in the first or second slot. You know?
Probably. Like
he's the most replaceable. Ah, I hate to be a jerk. He's the most replaceable out of that. If one of them had to get replaced and still have it sound like Rush, you think Neil Peart or Geddy could get replaced?
I don't think Rush could exist without the three of them.
Like Journey.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or Van Halen. Oh, wait, shoot. Van Halen switched.
Yeah. Well, they switched a few times. Yeah. Well, so did Journey. I mean, Journey did. They went with Steve Oteri. That was first after Steve Perry left. And then
they just did it because of the name.
Yeah. Right.
Like no one's going to notice.
That's right.
It'll sound just mumble it every day. Yeah. And lead singer Steve Oteri.
Yeah, and then Arnel Pineda, who, good singer, but he's not Steve.
Yeah.
Anyway, moving on. How did you come across these things?
Because the Rush thing was on YouTube in 10 parts, I found it.
Oh, okay.
So I watched that, and then some of the other things, like, if you liked that, you'll also like.
Right,
you
know, right.
Were some of these other clips.
Dylan interview is fantastic.
Yeah, one of Bob Dylan from like a late 90s 2020 interview.
Right.
Where the guy's asking him, you know, about a lot of the old stuff. He said, you know, I heard once that you wrote Blown in the Wind in an hour. And you know.
Yeah, it was like
Bob
minutes.
Dylan. Yeah, yeah, Bob Dylan's like, yeah, that sounds about right. You know.
Or wouldn't it be, yeah, it sounds about right.
Sounds about right.
Sounds about right.
And
I can't do Bob Dylan.
I know Bob Dylan's hard.
Ugh. Yeah, that was early Bob Dylan. Hey, Bill.
Yeah. So he says, where did it come from? Where did that song come from in an hour? This song that changed a generation, you know? And Bob Dylan didn't have a good answer. Well, he had the same answer anybody ever has whenever everyone asks him, like, how the hell did you make that thing? And they go, I don't know. I just made it.
Right.
You know? Comes from that place where the stuff comes, where the thing at the beginning of the river, where the spring is.
Yeah.
You know, God, you know, like, you know, what else are you going to say? Because there really is no answer to that question.
Well, he did later on in the interview. He does say that, you know, he made a deal with destiny.
Yeah, but that was that him making famous. A crossroads joke?
Maybe.
He said he knew he was going to be famous?
Yeah, he knew he was going to be famous. From a very young age.
Okay, but is that the kind of thing where it's just like, you know...
I think that's...
The one, you know, 10,000 people believe that they're going to be famous. The one guy who is says, see, I knew I was going to be famous because here I am being
I knew
famous.
I was going to be famous too, and here I sit in Rancho Cucamonga.
Yeah, right. That whole thing, right? But he says, you know, that like, you know, at that time in my life, and he was 20 years old.
Right.
Writing that stuff, you know? He was listening to Woody Guthrie. He was listening to, by the way, there was the whole This Machine Kills Fascists
right
sticker.
Right.
They had a Woody Guthrie t-shirt down at the Smithsonian Folklife Festival with that written in scrawl on like a drawing, an illustration of a guitar, like up the neck of the guitar.
Wow.
It was pretty cool. I almost got it. But you know, so he was studying these guys and then he took it a step further. He wrote piles of songs all within a handful of years that are some of the greatest songs ever written.
Right.
And he himself in this interview was just like, yeah, I couldn't do that again.
Yeah. And the guy was like, wait, you couldn't, you know? And
yeah.
He says, no.
What do you think of that?
I think that is absolutely true. I mean, look, Freddie Mercury wrote Bohemian Rhapsody when he was like 16 years old, you know?
Yeah. Before the mustache.
Yeah, that's right. When he was still little Farouk.
Yeah.
You know, who knows? Was it that sort of confluence of people that he was hanging out with, political climate, the headspace that he was in as a young man? Yep. I mean, was it all this
sort of
perfect?
He was a cool looking rough little Jewish kid from Nebraska, yeah, or wherever the hell he was from.
Was it just sort of this perfect storm? That he happened to be in that lasted, you know, it lasted several years. But but look, his, what was the one he won the Grammy for in the 90s?
Yeah,
what
the more I forget the name of the record.
Yeah, I mean, great record, recognized Grammy. Was it Blonde on Blonde?
Right.
No.
Was it recognized because Bob Dylan hadn't been recognized earlier?
Well, and this is the thing that kind of gets me about some of the awards. You know, are we giving awards to people because we go, oh wow, we haven't given them an award, we should give them this? I mean, they've done this movie, you know, or this record or whatever it is. We don't know if they've got much more in them, so should we give them this?
Yeah, they do that kind of stuff all the time. So maybe that's what it is. But I find it fascinating that a guy like Bob Dylan, who almost anyone would put on the list of top 20 artists of the last century, you know,
songwriters, sure.
Yeah. Is sitting there admitting that he had a burst of creativity at a certain time of his life that he couldn't replicate now.
Right.
You know, and is it, and how much of that is, to get back to the beginning of our conversation, the stuff with you, how much of that is him as 62-year-old Bob Dylan saying, oh man, I'm just tired.
Well, and did it contribute to him wanting to leave the business and leaving for a while?
Yeah.
Did he just go,
I'm becoming
what
a Christian.
I'm doing is crap, or what I'm doing is not Blonde on Blonde, so what's the point?
Right. I always wondered, like, when you listen to, you know, the new Paul Simon record or whatever.
Right.
Does Paul Simon really think that it's as good as Graceland or Bridge Over Troubled Water? You know,
does
Paul McCartney believe that the album he puts out now, you know, a couple of years ago, McCartney put out this record and I can't remember it. And it had this, it never happened to me before. You know that song?
Is that the Chaos and Creation in the Backyard?
Might be. And there's this one tune, It Never Happened to Me Before, which is amazing. And I remember I first heard it, like, as I thought it was the first song on the record, cause I like hit the wrong button or whatever. And I was like, oh my God, if this whole record is like this, Macca's back, you know?
Right, right.
And the rest of the album was, you know, and I was like, oh, crap, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And it was sort of like a glimpse of the genius now. You know, maybe Tom Waits is the same way. You know, I don't know. You know, those first few Tom Waits albums were pretty magical.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, it kind of... You know, you're right. It's right place, right time. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it goes to the young, right?
No, not at all. I mean, I think any number of artists in you know, across genres. If we're talking about music, I mean, they get a second wind. They come out with new records. They come out with new music, and it's fantastic.
Yeah. Right.
And just because it's not, I mean, is it an unfair comparison to compare, you know, Sting solo to The Police?
Right. Or Tina Turner comes back after 20 years and does.
Right.
Yeah.
Is that unfair? You know?
Yeah. Are they two different artists at a certain point?
Yeah. I mean, is Bob Dylan, you know, staying with him for a minute, is Bob Dylan now different than Bob Dylan then? Well, of course, I think you have to acknowledge that. So are you a different photographer now than you were 5 years ago? Of course you are. Am sure. I a different, whatever it is that I do? I don't even, that's part of my problem is how do I define myself? You know, but am I different now than when I was, you know, in 2000 or 2001? Absolutely.
Yeah. But I guess that's the whole thing, you know, sort of that where I was talking like, who am I kind of thing, you know,
mm-hmm.
It's like you can define yourself by these constructs you build around you. You know,
but that's my biggest struggle because I've always defined myself by what I do. And if I have no concrete direction of what I'm doing, then that fractures who I am to me.
Maybe that is ultimately the point of family. To be that scaffolding that is always there, regardless of where you are in the rebuilding of yourself.
Maybe. I hope. That's, I could see where that's true, but I hope it's not, because if it is, I have no scaffolding left.
Well, you have no blood scaffolding left.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
There are people you choose to be your family too.
Sure.
Chosen family, in my opinion, are as important or more important than, you know, the ones that we didn't get to choose.
Yeah, sure.
I don't know. I found it interesting the way that Dylan talked about.
Oh, it's great.
How
it's
he used to be.
Interview. Yeah, you know. His responses are great.
Yeah, so we're gonna put that one in the show notes.
Very, very different than you know the person who interviewed Zappa, which I
right just didn't who like asked all. Really terrible questions.
Yeah, you have cancer. Yeah. How does that make you feel? Yeah.
So you're like 50 something, and you're like kind of a musical genius, but now you can't play anymore because you're too tired because of the cancer.
Yeah,
how does that feel?
Yeah.
Every morning when you wake up and can't do the thing that you love to do.
Yeah.
What does that feel like?
Come on.
but I thought that some of Zappa's answers were fantastic.
Yes.
I've never been a huge Zappa fan. I understand why people love Zappa. And I can listen to certain things. Like, I think the guy who used to drive me to work in high school had Joe's Garage on all the time when we were uh-huh. driving to school. So now every time, it's Joe's Garage. Like, that's in my head all the time.
Right.
And I understand why he's important. And, you know, Steve Vai's awesome. But
I respect his body of work.
Yes.
But I was never a fan of his body.
There you go. That's me too. Right.
Yeah.
But there's this there and Zappa, you know, spent his whole life just kind of doing what he wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And there was an interesting thing in the Rush documentary where they were talking about, shoot, what was the record? Hemispheres or which one was it that they said was their like the third record?
That the was one that almost got them like almost destroyed their career?
No, the one after that where they put out
2112.
Another 2112. Oh, right. It was 2112. Thank you.
Yeah.
Where they were just like,
steel.
Yeah, we did it anyway. We did it the way we wanted to do it, even though they asked us to do it the way they wanted us to do it.
Right.
And they were terrified to put it out. Imagine nowadays having a band that has three records before they drop them. Like, we're going to let you put out three records.
Yeah.
Like, now it's like, yeah, put out that single in this one territory.
Right.
For 20 minutes and see how many people listen to it.
We've focus group your record and it's not good, so we're going to drop you.
Yeah. So they put out 2112 and like and everybody and apparently it like strikes a nerve, right?
That was the turning point. Yeah.
And they made a point where they said, you know, this is that's the record that gave us our freedom.
Yeah.
No one ever told us what to do ever again.
Right. Right.
And
Zappa did that his whole career, though.
Right, that's what I'm saying. It was Zappa.
The guy
was,
goes on what? He's playing a bicycle on what show? Was it the Steve Allen
Steve
show?
Steve Allen, yeah. So the question is, did Zappa ever have... Zappa never had the commercial success that Rush would have had. I don't know that he sold the kinds of records, the numbers of records that Rush would have sold. You know, people point to Zappa as an inspiration, as you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
As much as they do point to Zappa as the musician, you know, I mean, he's a fantastic musician. I'm just saying that, you know.
Yeah. Again, I think he's a terrific technical musician. I love his, you know, his approach to the way he does his art, and I respect the body of work. I wouldn't put it on and listen to it.
Yeah. So he says at one point, the interviewer in her infinite wisdom says, how do you want to be remembered?
Yeah.
And I can't remember. Does he say, I don't care or I don't know?
I think he says, I don't care.
Okay. Yeah. He's like, he said, it's not up to me. Something yeah. like that. And in a way that I think that somebody who is in the sort of health position that he's in can say that kind of thing. Right? Like he knows he's going to die, so he can look on his life in a very different way than you or I look on our lives now.
Yes, but I do think, I mean, just seeing how he responds, I don't think that's something that he came to. I think that it feels like that was a belief long held.
Yes.
That this isn't, you know, once I'm gone, I don't care.
Do you think he also didn't care what people thought of his records?
I don't know enough about him to know that, but it wouldn't surprise me if he right. were sort of the quintessential example of, I'm doing this for me. And if you're on board, great. And if you're not on board, there are plenty of other things to listen to.
Yeah. Yeah. I think about that and I go, okay, let's say for the moment that he really didn't give a crap and he was just doing what he wanted to do. He was obviously successful enough that he could afford to just do that. Right. Right. You know, like, you know, he was successful enough that he sold enough records and had enough fans that he could go on tour and hire the best musicians and go into the studio for 6 months to make something out of teapots and kettles.
Right.
And Steve Vai. And, you know,
and Steve Vai.
And Steve Vai. But at the same time, it's sort of like, would he have thought that if he wasn't successful? Would he have also said, you know what, I'm doing what I'm doing, get on the train or get out of my way and deal with it. And if that means I have to live in a crappy apartment somewhere in Minnesota, that's what I'll do.
Right.
You know, I guess my question is, are you and I just mentally weak? See what I'm saying?
In what way? No, in like, what way?
Is it that we just don't have enough chutzpah to say, I don't give a crap what you think of my work. I'm going to keep doing it.
Maybe. Maybe.
Yeah. And is that something to overcome or is that just an innate thing?
I'm hoping it's something to overcome. I'm hoping that the things that are slowly, probably too slowly, being put into motion are going to change and lessen some of the funk that I feel towards myself and what I do.
Yeah. I just, you know, I kind of, there was a little while there where I was working on stuff that people hired me for, but I wasn't making stuff just for me as much because I felt like, you know, the more people I take pictures of just for me, the less people that are going to want to buy what it is if they can get it for free. See what I'm saying?
Right, right.
There's a weird thing like that with portrait photography. You know, if I'm shooting people all the time just because I need fodder to shoot, well, then why would anybody ever say, oh, well, how about you take a break from that and I'll give you money to do it?
Yeah, but then how do you separate the personal work from the paying work?
That's a difficult. I mean, well, it's for magazines and commercial stuff. That's one thing. For sort of individual portraits and that kind of stuff, it's harder. Mm-hmm. It's actually a problem, you mm-hmm. know, because it's like, well, I want to shoot you and I want to do this thing. And yeah, I'd love for you. I know you need a new picture for LinkedIn, but, you know, if I was doing this for you, it would cost X amount, you know. That ends up being a little bit of a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But lately, I've just said, you know what, screw it. I'm just going to keep shooting. And, you know, and then if I shoot somebody and they want to use it for something, well, then we'll work out a few $100 so they can use it for whatever they want to use right. it for. But
what about like the Drabbles stuff? That was a fun period for you, right?
It was. Yeah. And you I'm know, sort
and,
of,
and are you going back there? It sounds like you're kind of getting back there.
I am getting back there, but the stuff that I'm trying to do is much more complicated because there's a lot more people involved.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the bitch of the whole thing is just trying to organize people, you know?
Right.
But yeah, I'm trying to get back there. You know, I'm doing that, and I'm doing this little in the corner thing that I'm working on, and I'm, you know, I've got like 4 or 5 irons in the fire right now, all of which are kind of slow burn.
Right.
It was simpler when I could do daily things that took less people and involved less planning, because I could just do a lot of them right in a row. But until I have the money to hire somebody at $50,000 a year to organize these things for me.
Yeah, right.
You know, some kid out of college, like.
Right, right.
Well, then, you know, then we'll be somewhere. But right now, you know, still trying to figure that out. Because ultimately, when you're working, that's when you do your best stuff, you know? Just work, 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 work.
Yeah, I completely agree with that.
Put your head down and make something, anything, because it's better than making nothing.
And maybe that's what's been, maybe that's where I've been stuck for the last several weeks or couple months.
Yeah,
is getting started and letting all of it feed off of each other.
Yeah. Yeah. I was there for months.
Yeah.
And now I'm trying to get out of it. You know, the summer helps, cause then it's like lighter outside, you know?
Yeah.
At least up here. Cause it, wintertime gets depressing. You know, there's an article on Huffington Post that I'll put in the show notes about all these illustrators, these people, like, and it shows stuff they did when they were kids, and then at different every couple of years as they got better and better at what they do.
Yep.
And it's you know, it's obvious stuff, but it's also a little bit inspiring to look at and go, oh, okay, these people weren't gods out of nothing. You know what I mean?
Sure.
They figured this stuff out, and they practiced, and they got better. You know, and there's something, you can't, there is an answer that says you can close your eyes and just run in this direction and you will get better. Now, there's arguments about like how fast you get better, whether there's better ways to do it, whatever it is, but you're not going to go backwards by practicing, you know?
And this first kid, I love, look at the big jump between 13 and 14. I think that's the most dramatic shift.
Yeah, between Steve Jobs and the guy next to him.
Yeah.
Who is that guy, the next guy over?
No. I mean, the first one, the Superman or whatever it is.
The Superman and then Steve
Jobs. And then Steve Jobs. I think that's Tobey Maguire, that next one.
Oh, could be. Yeah. This guy's thing with the water over the girl, the whole photorealistic pencil drawing thing blows my mind.
Yeah, or what about the ballpoint pen photorealism?
Yeah.
You know, where there's no erases.
Oh God. You know, some people just, it's like you, but it's funny because you think that these people, like this next one down with the one with Bryan Cranston and the girl, you know,
right.
And this is like 5 years away from each other. He goes from drawing what I would draw to drawing a photorealistic thing of Bryan Cranston. It's just kind of like, I guess there's practice in there, you know, cause
right.
But
the middle one is interesting because there are much more dramatic stylistic changes.
Yeah, he goes
much
from
more dramatic conceptual changes.
Yeah, like he felt like it seems like he almost hit a wall in his early, like late teens, early 20s,
mm-hmm.
and then kind of broke through and said, "Oh, I got to do stuff in color." You know.
Yeah,
but it's interesting that the guy was working with color at age 9 really well. I'm going to put this link in the show notes. It's called "These Amazing Before and After Drawings Show the Real Value of Practice."
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you know, back to that Rush interview where you know, Peart is talking about the punks and when they became, you know, when punk became new wave and all that. And he was talking to Stuart Copeland and they were talking about how the bass player for the Sex Pistols would be watching Sting play like over his shoulder. You know, because Sting was a really accomplished technical bassist and they wanted to learn what notes go together.
Yeah.
You know, because there is this you want to get better. No matter whether you're photographing or I'm drawing or writing or whatever it is, you want to get better.
Yeah. And that's the drive, right?
I think it's at least part of it, sure.
You want to get better, right?
I absolutely want to be better.
Why don't you tell me about this movie you watched, this Milius.
Oh, this was good. This was good. I've been in this documentary phase and part of it is because I'm looking for inspiration. I'm always looking for inspiration, but lately I haven't been hugely inspired. So I've been watching a lot of things and John Milius, writer, director, probably most well known for writing Apocalypse Now. Also directed Red Dawn, wrote Dirty Harry. You know, he's been around a long time. Really kind of helped change 70s cinema.
Jeffrey, get up here and piss in the radiator.
What?
Don't they make him piss, the kid piss in the radiator in Red Dawn? Oh. And gets a whole shot in it?
I'm sorry. I was like, wait, what? And so it's this fascinating look. And he, you know, he came up with Spielberg and Lucas and
that whole 70s crew.
That whole Scorsese and Coppola and
where did they all go to USC?
A lot of them went to USC. Spielberg did not go to USC. I think Spielberg went to, where did he go? Did he go to?
I'll look it up. You keep going.
I think he went to Long Beach and UCLA. I'm not sure. Anyway, but all these guys were trying to come up together, and they were getting noticed for different things. You know, when Milius first got in the Hollywood Reporter, you know, they were all kind of celebrating at each other's houses, and they would help each other on these projects. And one of the things that I found really interesting was Spielberg was doing Jaws, and he was working on the scene with in the boat with Robert Shaw and Dreyfus Roy Scheider, thank you. And it was that speech with the we all went into the water, you know, torpedo hit the boat and all the sharks and blah, blah, blah. And they didn't have that written, and Spielberg needed something for that scene. And he calls Milius, who proceeds to dictate.
Who had not worked on the movie before?
No,
that?
Wasn't working on the movie. Wasn't okay. Working on it. Just was a great writer of dialogue. Was a great writer of real kind of dialogue. And so Spielberg called him up, and over the phone he said that Milius dictates this, you know, 10 pages of dialogue that ultimately became that scene after Robert Shaw cut it down to 5 pages. But I just found
Which is funny because in many ways that's the scene that makes that movie more than just a monster movie.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a fantastic scene.
Yeah. We have to watch it every year because it's Conrad's birthday movie.
Ah, okay. Yeah, it's a great flick. But yeah, and I found it interesting how these guys were all kind of helping each other. You know, they would call and, hey, I need help on this. And you know, I get we can't always do that, but it seems like, it seems like we easily become precious about our art or our craft or whatever it is that we're doing. And we don't want to, we play it close to the vest for whatever reason. We don't want to allow other people into the process.
Have you ever asked for help, gotten help, and then regretted it because it wasn't what you wanted or?
Yes.
I think that that's an element of it too, where it's like, oh God, I could ask for help and bring somebody else into this, but it might actually just make things more complicated and worse.
Yeah, it may have taken me longer to get there by myself, but ultimately I think I would have gotten there.
Yeah, yeah.
Or there has been some of that. There has also been times where I've asked for help on projects, and it's taken the project in a direction that I couldn't have possibly foreseen, and the project was all the better for it.
Okay, that's fair enough.
So, yeah. Again, it's you don't know. You never know.
Yeah, yeah.
But
he's I'll put a link to this documentary. I'm gonna have to watch it because it's free for Prime people, right?
Free for Prime people. Yeah. Interesting though. And one of the other things, you know, he had a stroke, and lost his ability to speak.
Oh, I was gonna say of luck because
No. So here's this guy who, in his mind and in the minds of many people around him, was put on this earth to tell stories.
Yeah.
And has lost the ability to tell stories.
You know, sometimes I think about my niece is visually impaired.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, apparently she has a little more sight than they expected her to have and whatnot. But still, you know, there was a point at which I kind of thought, you know, this sucks. The thing that Uncle Billy does, she will never get to experience. You know?
Right.
And that kind of made me sad. Like, not only will she not get to experience it, but she can't even understand what it is. You know what I mean?
Okay, sure.
And it was, yeah, but imagine if you, one step further, Yeah, if you were a saxophone player, yeah, and you had a stroke and couldn't hold the trumpet up anymore or whatever.
Yeah.
Or a sax player.
You ever see the movie Once with Glenn Hansard?
I have not watched it, but it's on my list.
She, Marquetta, is talking about her father who killed himself in the movie, her character's father. He was a violinist, and he got arthritis and couldn't play the violin anymore, so he killed himself.
Yeah, what's the point?
Because he could no longer do that thing he was put here to do. And I found that interesting.
You think that's a drastic thing? Or do you think if you had that one thing and then couldn't do it, that would be a realistic option for you? Is anything in life that singularly important?
I would be lying if I said I hadn't considered it for less.
That sounds like you need to go see somebody.
Well, not recently, but... Yeah. I have in the past.
Sure. Yeah. Life is hard.
It can be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what makes
you know, we were going to
go ahead. No,
say, you know what's not hard? Go ahead. Look at that.
You know what makes life easier, Jeffrey?
I'm in your head, Wadman.
Squarespace.com.
They do. Hey, we just did a Squarespace site for Nick for her new site.
And how'd it come out?
It's terrific. Simmerandshoot.com. Look, you know what? Go look at it right now. Simmerandshoot.com. Look at that photograph. If that doesn't make you hungry, that first photograph of that big sandwich.
I'm pulling it up. Oh, look at that.
Gorgeous.
Bacon and apple?
Apple, bacon, avocado. Yeah, that was something they did featured on the Today Show. Oddly
oh,
enough.
Right. One of those.
Yeah. But yeah, it took about, I'm going to say conservatively a half hour to build the site. And that was because we imported an existing WordPress site, which went off without a hitch.
Right. Yeah.
A couple little formatting things, but by and large, it pulled it all in. Yeah. Pulled it all in.
Look, Squarespace is the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, and online store. For a free trial and 10% off, visit squarespace.com and enter the promo code OTP as in OTP as in on taking pictures at checkout. A better website, a better web starts with your website, Jeffrey.
And it does.
Now let's look at this. Are the websites built on Squarespace simple and easy to use?
Yes.
Do they
especially with Layout Engine 2? That thing
is pretty impressive. Could you imagine coding that?
Nope.
Beautiful. Oh. Do they have beautiful design?
Yes.
Yeah, they really do. Can you drag and drop your content in so you don't have to go searching through your drive like in a Finder window?
Yes.
They have 24-hour support through live chat and email. You know where that's located?
If you're logged in, you just click the little help button and it's right there.
Boom. There they are.
Yeah. There's a whole knowledge base there, yeah. Like an internal knowledge base.
And the people you're talking to are in New York City and now in Dublin. Yeah. Dublin. Can't do an Irish. Can you do an Irish accent?
No.
Okay.
Everything sounds like a question.
Is that what they do? Is that the Irish thing?
Isn't it?
I could sing drinking songs.
We're going to the pub?
Going to the pub?
I don't know.
Plans start at just $8 a month.
Apologies for those of you listening in Ireland at Bill and I butchering your heritage.
Plans start at just $8 a month and include a free domain name if you sign up for a year. So make sure you go do that. They have responsive designs are built into all of the templates. So stuff looks good on your phone, on your iPad, on your, you know, random other tablet from someplace in China.
It's a little disturbing that you can't even think of one other tablet.
Well, they look good on my Nexus 7. Is that fine?
There you go. There you go.
They have e-commerce and online stores. So every site comes with an online store. So like the $8 a month plan, I think you could sell one item. So if you just want to have product, like a tip jar or whatever, and then it goes up from there. And you could start a trial with no credit card required. And you can start building your website today for free. Try it out for 2 weeks. And when you decide to sign up for Squarespace, when you've imported all your stuff, made it look the way you want, and then you A-B it between your old website and the new Squarespace one, and you go, oh, wow, that is much better. Then you go over, you use the offer code OTP, and you'll get 10% off your first purchase. And to show your support for On Taking Pictures, go over to Squarespace, and use the code. So thank you very much to Squarespace for supporting 5x5 and Not Taking Pictures. Squarespace, a better web starts with your website.
Honest to God, if you started right now,
yep,
you could have a site built
before the end
time
of the show.
We finish the show. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Had you started at this point in the last time we recorded the show this morning,
you could have done 4 or 5 sites. Wise ass. It's better though, right? Come on.
It's good. It's a good show. Yeah.
All right.
Where do you want to go from here?
Okay. You wanted to talk about it.
We don't have to talk about
no,
this.
No, it's fine. It's fine.
We'll do it quick.
Yeah.
There was an article on
Bill's favorite website,
BuzzFeed.
That's right.
Talking about that whole back and
forth. We should do Bill Feed. We should just rip off BuzzFeed completely and just do Bill Feed.
You do understand that there is Wattpedia.
Yeah.
Not even kidding.
Yep.
Wattpedia.com. It's called Terry Richardson Isn't Much of an Artist, yep. Art Critics Say. And
from the department of Captain Obvious, from the desk of Captain Obvious.
Yeah, and it's all these art people saying, you know, critics said it would be laughable to mention Richardson in the same sentence as giants of recent photography to whom his defenders sometimes liken him, figures like Robert Mapplethorpe and Nan Golden.
Right.
Who I still don't get. Who's explicitly sexual.
Go read the spotlight.
I saw it yesterday. Topics draw comparison to Richardson, but whose attention to visual form and language are entirely different. And they liken Richardson to Annie Leibovitz, and he says, like Annie Leibovitz, Richardson's first allegiance is to whoever hires him, and his primary purpose is commercial. The thing is, I think a lot of Annie Leibovitz images are really, really fantastic. I know lots of people poop on her.
You know, I love Annie Leibovitz's images.
Annie Poop Leibovitz.
No, I think she's fantastic. And I don't think Richardson's first allegiance is to whoever hired. I think his first allegiance is to perpetuating his fame bubble that he lives in.
Yeah,
I really do.
See, that's what I'm thinking.
It's to perpetuate this sort of, you know, pervert auteur thing that he's got around himself.
Yeah, yeah. And I just
to compare his work to Annie Leibovitz at all is offensive.
Right. I thought that was going too far because I think a lot of Annie Leibovitz stuff does stand on its own as art.
Absolutely.
In a way that I don't think much Terry Richardson stuff does.
Absolutely.
But anyway, it was interesting. And this is maybe a topic for discussion for the group would be, you know, where is the line between art and commercial? Is just because you do it for a client mean that it's commercial and therefore not art? Or can it be both? Can it be for art and then it gets used for a commercial purpose? Is that now commercial or is that still art? And who gets to decide if not, you know, the professor from UCLA and the, you know, review guy from the New York Times?
Going back to Avedon. The stuff that he did for Harper's, for Alexei Brodovich.
Yeah.
That was commercial.
True.
But is it not art?
Yeah, I don't know.
You know, is the stuff for the American West, is that art? Or is it not because it appeared in a book? So then it's commercial because you can buy the book.
Yeah,
these seem to be fairly ridiculous notions.
They're distinctions that, you know, it's a weird, interesting thing is it feels like people on the art side of things, like the museum-y kind of people, and gallery kind of people want to maintain the specialness of art.
Yes.
With a capital A.
Yes.
And refuse to allow anything else to be, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. If it's not special, then you can't charge $142 million for it.
If it's not just for them, then it doesn't matter.
Right. I think that's one of my biggest
There's a weird exclusivity thing.
Yes.
Where it's like, unless we deem this art, it's not, and just get out of our way.
Yes. Why is somebody painting with a sable hair brush more important than somebody painting with a spray can?
Yep. True.
Ridiculous to me.
Yeah. So I'm going to put this link in the show notes, and maybe this is a topic for discussion, or, you know, write in at podcast@ontakingpictures.com.
There you go.
And let us know what you think. It's on BuzzFeed. I'll put the link in the show notes. Some guy threw his car, his drone. guy flew his drone through fireworks down in Florida.
Is this a good idea? I don't think it's a good idea, but I think the footage is really cool.
This guy had just some disposable income, I think.
Well, if the thing had, you know, caught fire and careened into the crowd, he would have even had more disposable income. But then again, it looks like he flew it over a lake.
Yeah, it looks like it's over the water, probably the intercoastal waterway or something.
Yeah, it looks like even if one of the bursts had hit this thing, it looks like it would be
now that would have been some cool footage.
Yeah, right. The thing just bend over end down to the water. Because you know the GoPro would have survived.
It
right?
just flips. It just
It's interesting though. It's really interesting.
Do you think the stuff that people are doing with drones really is that innovative, or it's just the latest thing in a different way to move the camera and it's going to get old and then move back to what it should be, which is a special tool reserved for special reasons why you need that move?
Probably.
You understand what I'm saying?
Sure. The how many people are going to do this after? How many bullet time knockoffs did we see after bullet time?
Yep.
You know, how many bad 3D movies are you going to see for every one good one?
True.
If you can find a good one.
Yeah.
I think this will be overused, but for the first one, yeah, he'll get some juice out of it, and it's interesting. Is it a one trick kind of a pony thing, or is this guy? I don't know anything about this guy. Is he a budding cinematographer?
I have no idea.
Or is he a guy with a grand to spend on a drone?
He's a guy with 2 million hits to his video on YouTube.
Yeah,
which means that he's going to direct the next Star Wars movie.
That's right.
Wait, it doesn't work that way? I didn't realize that.
That's exactly the way it works.
Yeah.
Some of the moves are a little too fast. His pans are really fast.
It's still impressive, though.
Yeah, but yeah, it's interesting.
Who sent this in? This link to us, Edward Allen. This morning gets it in under the bell.
That's right.
Daily routines of famous creatives, and what's interesting about it is there's sort of an info graphic, which has sleep, creative work, day job, and admin crap they have to do, food and leisure, exercise, and other. And it has their days blocked out on a 12 a.m. to 12 a.m. chart to show when they went to sleep, when they woke up, you know. And it's got Milton and Voltaire and Ben Franklin and Charles Darwin and, you know.
It's kind of interesting.
Kafka and Picasso. I like it because it's not like, oh, we're going to talk about specific time, you know. It's, and then it breaks it up into showing just where their creative work was.
Uh-huh.
And some of them only did stuff for like an hour a day.
Yeah.
And others did it for like 10 hours a day, you know. And I think that's pretty cool. Like, it looks like Picasso worked from 10 p.m. to 4 a.m.
Yeah, looked through the night. Only a couple people though.
I like working at night.
I do too. Look, Mozart did it. Looks like that.
Yeah.
Kafka.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting.
It is. It's a fascinating little infographic.
So we're gonna put that. We'll put that in the show notes too. Because, you know, it just goes to show people work in different ways, right? You know, one of us may need to sit down and do stuff for 6 hours a day. Another one may just wait till it, you know, it hits you, and then genius comes. You know.
I like this this quote by Flaubert. Be regular and orderly in your life so that you may be violent and original in your work.
It's a good quote.
That's good.
Yeah. Are you regular in your life? Do you have a routine?
Yes.
My cycles have cycles.
I am near obsessive about some of my routines.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things, if I'm being honest, which I try to be, that holds me back, is I adhere too much to...
You'll say, no, I can't work on that now because I'm supposed to be working at such and such because it's 2 p.m.
Or, you know, this is my this time, or you know, whatever it is. I think I need to become more fluid about certain things.
Interesting.
And just not hold on to some... Some of them are just obsessions.
Yeah. I need to get more structured. You need to become more fluid, apparently.
You know? Some of them are just, you know, don't check the burners 4 times before you leave the house, or don't,
right,
you know, all that kind of stuff.
I had there's a guy I used to do Gonzalo Silva, the bass player, vocalist that I used to record.
What a great name.
Yeah, Gonzalo Silva.
Gonzalo Silva.
He's really good. I think his stuff's on like Spotify, and I'm sure he's got a website and whatnot. And he had a song. He, you know, he goes in and out with sort of drinking and drugs. Like he's got a little bit of a addictive personality. And he has a song called Habit, and one of the lines in it is something along the lines of, you know, this process of falling back in and getting out again has become its own habit, you know.
Like, nice.
And it's a really good line. I forget the exact words, but it's just, it kind of, it's funny, you know, in that it's like my habit has become an addiction unto itself.
Right, right. You know?
So what else do we have left? We got, let's see.
Where are we at on time?
We're at almost an hour and a half.
Okay.
So let's, you want to talk about the Ira Glass or you want to save that for another time?
I mean, it's not a big deal. You know, Ira Glass took This American Life and left PRI and has gone independent. It doesn't mean much in the grand scheme of things other than I found it interesting the idea of leaving the perceived security of a patron or a backer or an underwriter to go it alone.
Although in his situation, he is very successful and it was the middleman that was holding him back.
Right, right, right.
You know,
I wonder if this will spark other people to do the same, like Radiolab or The Moth or some of the other bigger shows.
Yeah, maybe. Man, Radiolab seems like a lot of work. You know, we said last time, though, that you know, they were saying in the article that it's like a seven-figure budget for This American Life, which means it's millions of dollars. So if it's not, you know, $8 million, let's say it's $3 million or $2 million. But even in the picture, the production picture, they've got like 20, 30 people in the room.
Yeah, so, it's a pretty large staff, it looks
like. Yeah, like I don't think that there's a lot. It's not, there's not millions of dollars flowing through there into his pockets. You know?
No, and he's that was kind of the other thing was, you know, he's requested that his salary be lowered after it reached a high in 2013.
Does it say how much he made?
Yes. In recent years, he took home about $170,000 in compensation and benefits, commensurate with senior producers on the show, a figure that went up to $278,000 in fiscal year 2013. But then, quote, feeling weird about it, end quote, he asked to lower his salary the following year to $146,000. And this year, I asked to lower it again, he wrote in an email. It's still a lot of money. So he's volunteering to cut his salary in half.
That's pretty cool.
I think it's really cool.
I have felt weird about making a lot of money myself at times when I've made money. It feels like, wait a minute, who the hell am I to, you know?
And again, I don't know this guy, but that just speaks to, look, put it into the show.
Yeah, yeah. Which says something about him, you know what I mean?
I think it does, yeah.
I like This American Life sometimes it drives me crazy. Mm-hmm. Like the way they present things, sometimes it's the same exact sort of structure every time. You know, it's like, say something quirky and then stop for like a little jazz interlude until they like comes back in. You know what I mean? Like,
but that's their hook.
Right. That's their whole thing. And it grates on me. It's like I can hear it coming and I was just like, oh, she's going to say this thing and then wait for like the little drum beat to do this thing before she continues the story 20 seconds later. Mm-hmm. But the fact that he does it all the time and the fact that he seems to do it for him is pretty great.
Seems to. Yeah. I mean, he seems to be doing the show that he wants to listen to.
Yeah.
And I, if that's the case, hats off, Ira.
Yeah.
A lot of respect for that.
And you know what? Look, he can, you know, be fine on $150,000 a year. Then again, maybe he has like family money or something we don't know about.
Yeah. This is the kind of story, though, that I find inspiring. This is the kind of thing that makes me want to go, okay, go sharpen your pencils.
Yep.
Go sit down.
Yep.
Shut up and get to work.
Yeah. Get your black wing.
Yeah.
Get your books.
Get my little notebooks. Yeah. Get my coffee and just go find something that you want to celebrate and start writing.
Yeah.
And that's why I like this.
Maybe the trick is to not, like, lately I've been putting stuff out. I have Twitter feed over to Facebook.
Yep.
But I go to Facebook like once every couple of days just to make sure no one's trying to message me about something important for some reason.
Right.
But I don't really go to Facebook that much anymore and it helps. Not
I haven't
watching all the time,
time.
It helps.
Yeah.
It's a waste of time and energy. And it also feels like it's a energy suck for me. I don't feel, yeah. I never feel better after looking at Facebook. You know?
I have just been trying to find things that are inspiring or things that, that allow me to see out of my comfort zone. This next conversation for Process Driven, I'm talking to a photographer who sold everything he owns and moved to Europe and just did portraits in the streets in Europe.
Cool.
And that has sort of had some emotional ramifications, but it's also had some professional ramifications in that he's gotten gigs because of people seeing this work and going, we want that.
Right.
We want that look and feel for our, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah.
So I think that's going to be an interesting talk.
That sounds like
and again,
fun.
Well out of my comfort zone. The idea of just, I mean, I think I love the idea of just picking up and going.
Yeah.
But
you don't think you'd ever do it?
I don't know that I've got the stones for it. I'm trying to find that because I think it would be a fascinating journey. And if I really believe that it's about the journey, and I try to, Bill, I try to believe it's about the journey and not about the destination, but it seems like the destination is what I keep getting hung up on.
Right.
So if I can get to that point, then maybe there's a journey out there. Maybe there's an extended road trip out there for me. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm trying. That's all I can do.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll go to Atlanta. Who knows?
Hotlanta.
Hotlanta.
Tell me about how the people did last week on last week's assignment.
They completely kicked ass, like every week. I mean, yeah. You guys are putting up some absolutely terrific work.
Are they rocking the suburbs?
Rocking it. Yeah. So on the job was the last assignment, and there were really terrific things from all sorts of different, you know, jobs and professions, and whether people were part of it or observing, you know, either passive or active, really some fantastic stuff. So thank you guys for putting up this great stuff. Still some entries on the tiny, people love the tiny planet.
Tiny planet's fun.
Yeah. Yeah. So on the job was the last one. Keep going. If you have some great stuff for on the job, keep putting them in there. Just tag it on the job.
What else you got?
This one. What do you think of this one? It's in the show notes. Is it too limiting? Should it be opened up a little more? I was thinking circles.
I think circles is good. I think we go there.
Circles? All right.
Absolutely.
Circles. I was thinking about patterns and texture, but we've already done those. So let's refine it a little more and get out and look for circles. Rounded corners, rounded edges.
Okay. I like that.
Circles.
One.
Little circles.
That one is definitely doable.
Circles in the sand.
Really? Is that a
Go-Go song?
Yeah.
Belinda Carlisle or something.
So good.
The 80s.
It's good stuff.
So circles, that'll be the next one. Congrats to Fred Levy for his Fred, friend of the show, just scored a book deal for his Black Dogs project.
Oh yeah, that thing's cool.
Black Dogs.
I love the look of the lighting in those is fantastic.
You were saying that it's really hard to light black well.
Yeah, because he's doing black on black. He's shooting black dogs on a black background, but giving the black hair just enough light that it stands out from the black background.
So what's the trick? Is it position? Is it modifier?
Really soft. My guess is that he's using really soft sources and kind of putting them up above. And uh-huh. But he's like one above and one to the side because he's also getting these nice little rim lights to. It's good.
Does the light have to be really close for that? Or what?
I don't know exactly how he's doing it, but I will tell you that it's one of those things where I look at it and I go, okay, this would be hard enough to do if you were shooting a stuffed black dog. But a dog that's moving?
Right.
That's even harder, you know? So, NAD props. Congratulations, too.
Interesting stuff.
Yeah. What else you got?
Dogs and kids, right?
That's the tough ones. Bad.
bad. But that's all you've got to say. Just bad.
I'll tell you, I took pictures of my niece and nephew this weekend, and that was hard enough.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Do they like having their photographs taken?
Bert does.
Yeah.
You try to say have him say cheese, but he says poop instead.
Nice.
Poop.
Because poop.
Because he's four.
Yeah.
Who's our photographer of the week?
Photographer, this came from another listener, Anton Fortin. Would that be it?
Inside joke for listeners from the beginning.
That's right. Yeah. Anton sent in Daido Moriyama.
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 there is a certain like Moriyama.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it's probably on the M. Anyway, go ahead.
You may have some difficulty with his site. His site is a Flash site and is very stubborn about loading. So maybe we can put in like just a Google image search link or something, because now the thumbnails are loading, but if you click into any particular section, those sections aren't loading.
See, those are the problem. That's the problem I was having.
Yeah, you just get the little spinny...
I'll put a link in the show notes.
Yeah, but interesting stuff. When you and I were talking about this earlier, I was like, oh, I don't know this guy. But I do remember seeing him at his work at Paris Photo, because there were these photographs of Japanese women bound in like rope. And I didn't get it. It didn't sit very well with me. But again, when you read about what he's trying to do with his work,
yeah,
then maybe it makes a little more sense. I don't like those particular photos anymore, but he does have some really terrific street photos.
Yeah, yeah. The street photos are fantastic, and really, it's like he does that whole crushed blacks thing
mm-hmm.
that we're fans of on this show.
What did you say he was using? What's the Ricoh?
Oh, I looked it up later. Yeah, that little Ricoh. I had it open. Now I lost it. That weird little Ricoh camera,
like a little pocket camera, right?
Yeah. Well, because when you search for pictures for him, when I went down far enough, I ended up with a picture of one of those, and I was like, "What the heck is that?" And I'm gonna I'm gonna put it in the show notes, because there's actually a video called Daido Moriyama and the Ricoh GR series. Great insights into the masters of compact camera, Daido Moriyama. A wonderful video, all 12 minutes. He shares his insights into the world, the compact camera, and yes, the Ricoh GR digital series of camera.
Interesting, yeah.
That's like it's an APC-C size sensor, fixed lens, very small. Some people really swear by it.
So like Ricoh's version of like the X100 or something?
Yes, except this one came out a long time ago. Or what, the first ones came out like 2007 or something like that.
Wow. Are they still making them?
Yeah, they're like $700.
Huh.
They are 16 megapixels, I think. Yeah, 16 megapixels. No low-pass filter. So they're very much like the Fuji. And now Ricoh now owns Pentax. So like that 645Z is actually made by Ricoh.
No kidding.
Yep.
Okay, here we go. GR21, high-end, blah, 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 blah. Huh.
Yeah, and you could buy an external viewfinder for it. Some people really swear by this camera. It's a weird little funky one.
Interesting.
It's very, very different. If anybody out there has one of these things, give us a call to our voicemail. It's 347-687-9411, or send us an email, podcast@ontakingpictures.com, and let us know how it is. I'd be interested to know what it feels like to use. But yeah, apparently he uses one of these things, and then he just crushes his blacks, does like super high contrast, you know?
Yeah. I really like the work, other than the bound up Japanese girl. I don't really like that.
Just because you're not into bound Japanese women.
That might be it. I'd rather look at the fish head.
Yeah.
You know, whatever. Yeah. Maybe that's something
you should talk to somebody about too.
Yeah, exactly. You were saying too that he does these halo-y things where he'll dodge out like...
Yeah, those are kind of weird,
unnaturally
right?
Naturally dodged, yeah.
Where it'll look like... It looks like really ham-fisted Photoshop work, which
yes.
he must be doing on purpose.
But you have to wonder why.
I don't know. Yeah, where he'll like it'll be all dark except for, you know, some kid in the middle who's like even more contrasty and sort of just blown out halos. Like
right.
Yeah. It also, I love the picture. I always love pictures of snow with a flash.
Yeah.
You know, where it's just like little dots of stuff.
Wait, so did this camera come out as a film camera? Or was it always a digital camera?
I thought it was always a digital camera. It's a weird, that's a very odd camera. In fact, June 2013, DP review of it. I'll put the review in the show notes. We'll see what they say. But yeah, if he's using something like that, he's just walking around the street snapping away.
Yeah, snapping away. Yeah.
They give it a gold award.
Do they really? Yep. On DP review?
Yep. Excellent image quality, sharp lens, blah, 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 blah. Yeah.
And they're like $700?
Yep.
Huh.
It's like a pocket camera for somebody who wants, you know, it's like a little street pocket camera.
Interesting. Yeah. Put it in the notes.
Yeah. Anything else?
I think we're good.
Anything else about Daido Moriyama?
Daido Moriyama. No, thanks Anton for sending that in.
Yeah. Who sent it in again?
Anton 14.
There you go. Yeah. Anything else you want to tell people? Podcast@ontakingpictures.com.
Yeah. Yeah.
The phone number once again, 347-687-9411. And I'm Bill Wadman. You're Jeffrey Sidoris on Twitter.
Yep.
You're at Faded and Blurred. I'm at BillWadman.com.
Yep.
Anything else?
Nope.
All right.
Nope. I'm gonna go get some food. I'm now inspired by your Chipotle chicken sandwich. I want to go look for one.
Maybe you should just bring the picture and show it to your local guy and go, make one of these.
This is what I want. You make this now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I know, that would be great.
Stop playing games with me, Tony.
Yeah, come on. Yeah. Hook me up with the Chipotle. Yeah. Come on now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for listening, everyone.
See you next week.
See you next week.
This way, say what you wanna say, though I know your words will lay me out, so I can hear you think out loud. Going through your thoughts the way I have for too long, it's clear to me this way. Say what you wanna say. I know what you will say will leave me out.